Okay, well, thank you very much for coming, and I just want to thank Jesus Christ again for saving my life a couple years ago. Some of you might know, but I was in Afghanistan, and there was a terrorist attack, and is that okay? Can you hear me? So I managed to survive 7 hours in my office hiding, and the Lord is the best Savior ever. So now this is an area that I was interested in since 1998, roughly. I didn't necessarily choose to work in this area on my own. I wouldn't have thought of the idea. I was very skeptical at first, but my boss at that time, he gave me the problem, so he got me to work on it. Also, I realized before that my advisor at Princeton had thrown me a problem. You know, he asked me questions about tachyonic quantum field theory, and because I was working on my thesis, I didn't really want to deal with that, so I made up a quick and dirty argument to dispose of the problem, and you'll see what happened. I'll try to explain that. I assumed strict Lorentz symmetry and causality was violated, and so I didn't have to think about that anymore, so I could finish my thesis. So, but later on, since other people were asking me similar questions, I tried to think of it a little different way and ended up, I'll talk about that later too, why I decided to actually take it more seriously. So I wanted to consider the concept of tachyons, and in particular, the possibility of the neutrino, which is a known elementary particle, as we already heard about, might be such a particle. So to do that, this was a rough outline, and I've since modified it, so I'll actually start a little bit more of neutrino history, a little bit more about the neutrino, which hopefully will complement what the previous speakers have said about neutrinos, or this particular previous speaker. I'm sorry, I forgot your name. But okay. So neutrinos were originally postulated as particles by Wolfgang Pauli, who was attempting to solve the missing mass problem in beta decay, which was existing at that time, which was causing a lot of consternation. Niels Bohr was considering dropping the principle of conservation of energy, even. I mean, that was how drastic and desperate that problem was at that time. This is 1929 or so. So Pauli has a great sense of humor. He announced his discovery of this particle. It wasn't a press conference. He actually avoided coming to a conference and made the excuse that he was going to a ball. And he said, he started it off with, "Dear radioactive ladies and gentlemen," because it was a conference about radioactivity, and proceeded to then introduce the concept of a new particle at that time. So the known elementary particles up to that time were the electron, the proton, and photon, actually. I think those were the only three. Einstein had just postulated the concept of light being a particle. Not even the neutron was known at that time. So Pauli initially tried to call this particle the neutron. So that name had not yet been assigned to any particle yet. It was only 1932 that the neutron was discovered by Chadwick. So Fermi gave us the name neutrino, which in Italian means little neutral one. So that's where the name comes from. Okay, so with the addition of this particle, the problem of the missing energy is essentially solved. So, and not only that, but there was a problem with lack of conservation of angular momentum in this equation. That was also solved because the neutrino was postulated to have spin 1/2. The neutron and the protons and electrons all have spin 1/2, and according to, you need to conserve angular momentum and just in one direction, and that's allowed if you have the odd number of fermions on each side. Okay. So the neutrinos are found to interact only through the weak interaction, as was already mentioned. The mass was thought to be very small initially, at least I think 1/50th of the mass of the electron, but a short time later, it was that number became 1/50, 1/500, and so on. It became they thought for a long time, theorists thought that the mass was zero. Well, in fact, you'd see that in textbooks on quantum field theory. You'd have a massless equation, and it would be used a fermionic massless equation, and it would be used to describe the neutrino. And I'll get into that a little bit later. So, as to why, and, you know, other reasons why they thought it might be, it should be zero, or the probability was strong that it would be zero. Okay, so here's some examples of a beta decay spectrum, and I'm showing the, you know, if the missing mass problem was the energy came out as in the form of electrons, so they would measure the electron energy coming out of the nucleus. The recoiling nucleus would have low momentum, and they correspondingly take away less energy, a very very small amount of energy compared to the electron. So. But if there were only one particle emitted, then it would all be expected to be emitted at the same energy, which is shown here. Oops. Okay, I guess I should be using, you can't see the mouse, I guess, so sorry. Is there a laser pointer somewhere else? Okay, sorry. Oh, okay. Oh, I see. Oh, this way. I see. I got it. I'm just holding it upside down. I was pointing it at myself. So, one thing I should learn to check that, because once I was in a park and I met a bear and I realized I had bear spray and I was getting it out, and I looked at it and I realized I was pointing towards myself. So that would have been, this has happened before. Okay, so here we see all the energy in one lump here if there were only one particle. So this missing energy is sort of, you know, if there's another particle, then it can come out with you know, different amounts of energy as well. So you'd have to conserve momentum between all the particles. So, but the energy, most of the energy, all the energy would be split between the electron and the other particle, the neutrino or the antineutrino in this case. Okay, actually, the momentum would be also very small for the recoiling nucleus. So basically, the two momenta of the two outgoing particles would be the same. So those constraints are used to come up with a beta decay spectrum, and it looks something like this. So if the neutrino has a mass, so this is the most sensitive kind of experiment that can be done today, especially using tritium, which is hydrogen with two other neutrons, decaying into helium-3. So if there is a... am I too loud? Or okay. If there a neutrino has a mass, then the spectrum will fall short of the endpoint here by what's called the mass gap. So this is the energy of the outgoing electron. This is the number of electrons that you see in that in each energy bin here, in the width of energy. And near the end, if the neutrino has a mass, you see it fall short. It sort of drops, theoretically, it would drop at straight down at the end. And then if it's massless, then it would come up, it would go with a sort of a more gradual descent there and reach zero at the end point only. Okay, so some interesting things about the neutrino. In the mid-1950s, we had what was called the parity revolution. So T.D. Lee and C.N. Yang in 1957, they were at the Institute, and they were noticing anomalous results in the theory of the weak interactions. So they postulated that there was something called the tau theta puzzle, and they postulated the solution to that would be that parity might be broken in the weak interactions. And that... resulted in an experiment shortly thereafter at Columbia, I believe, Madame Wu, who did find this parity breaking using I'm not an experimentalist, so I'm not familiar with all the details. I was this cobalt something, cobalt 40 or something, I forget. But so famous experiment. Unfortunately, she didn't win the Nobel Prize. I don't understand why, but the two Chinese here did, and Chinese American. Goldhaber then actually did this, is told a clever experiment to actually distinguish which of the particles was left-handed, which is right-handed. So the neutrino was found to be left-handed, the antineutrino right-handed. And so far this has been seen in all the experiments. So this is a very curious thing about neutrinos, because if the neutrino is just an ordinary electron, as I'll show shortly, should be expected, you know, if it's a massive particle like the electron, it should have, if it has one-handedness, then it should have the other-handedness. Another interesting thing about the neutrino is that somebody suspected that early on that the pion decay also might involve a neutrino, because there was also missing energy there. It turned out that it does emit a neutrino. A pion emits a muon plus a neutrino, but the neutrino has a different type than the electron neutrino that's given off in beta decay. So the electron neutrino is associated with electrons. Okay, you see it here. Whenever you have an electron coming out, you have a neutrino, antineutrino in this case, also coming out, or it could be on the other side. They have to balance. It's called lepton number conservation. And it's initially it was thought to be flavor specific eventually. So this idea of flavor specific lepton number conservation led to the search for an attempt to prove that the neutrino coming from a pion decay was different than the one coming from electron decay, and that turned out to be the case. So I believe that also won a Nobel Prize. Perel then discovered the tau particle, the third in the lepton family, and neutrino was then postulated to exist also for the tauon in parallel with the other two flavors. So. And direct evidence for that was found evidently by Donut in 2000. I don't know, maybe that's old information, but at least it was in a book that I have, it published in 2001, that was sort of a note added in proof. Okay, so now tachyons and all that. I wanted to talk about the history a little bit. Well, Feinberg I mentioned, Sudarshan, I think the first paper came out by Sudarshan, Deshpande, and Beleniuk. Basically, it's the idea that when relativity was first postulated, one could see that the argument that Einstein used to show that electrons, or that you know, I mean, he said in the paper, and you know, it was what he said was true, that particles cannot be found going faster than light. Okay, well, that's, but the proviso was that the particles started off slower than light. So he said he was able to prove that particles that start off slower than light always remain slower than light. But he kind of made the assumption that no particles existed that could be created starting off faster than light. So he didn't really consider that case. So there was, you would expect then that those particles would have to stay faster than light. So I'm going to skip this. I don't quite have this in the right order. I'm gonna just review the postulates of special relativity and show how I think of them in a little bit of a tweaked way in order to accommodate this possibility. So in ordinary special relativity, speed of light is considered to be, here are the two main principles. The speed of light is constant or is the same in all inertial frames. The second one is that the laws of physics which are the partial differential equations or the algebraic equations, are mutatis mutandis. That means if you have spin, then you have a transformation on the spin as well of the equation. So there's some way in which you can view the partial differential equations as being the same in all frames. So what this leads to is equations for describing transformation of observed things like position and energy momentum according to the different inertial observers that you might have. And this is just flat space-time, so we're just considering inertial observers. The equations, both the equations and the spectra of particles are then invariant under so-called Lorentz transformations, which are boosts and rotations, and you also include time and space translations to make it the Poincaré group. So the whole Lorentz and translations give you the Poincaré group. Now I tweak this a bit. I still assume the speed of light is the same in all inertial frames, and I assume the equations are the same, mu tandis, mu tandis in all reference frames, but I'm differentiating between, so to speak, the partial differential equations and the initial conditions. Here I'm assuming that the initial conditions are also the same in some sense. So here I'm not assuming that. And so I'm allowing for the possibility you would still have translation invariance, but Lorentz symmetry is broken down to basically in the simplest case, a group that's isomorphic or it's conjugate to the rotations. So what this essentially means is you can have a preferred frame in which things are invariant under rotations in this frame, but there's a special aspect about this frame is that all the tachyonic energies are positive. 5 minutes. Okay. So, okay, I didn't realize I was taking so little. Okay. All right. So then, so you can have a rotation. You can have rotation invariance, but you're breaking the symmetry with respect to boosts. Okay. So. Well, I guess I'm sorry. I didn't practice this talk at all. So I guess I'll just have to really wing it here. But sorry for that. So the idea is I want to consider quantum field theory with the Ron Klein-Gordon equation. I find that I can have a theory which satisfies axioms of similar to quantum field theory and curved space-time, namely quasi-free nature, local commutativity, and there's a wavefront sets spectral condition, which is a long thing, not a long story, but that was what I was working on at the time, which allows for renormalizability. But symmetry is broken. Okay, so here's what I want to at least leave you with. Is that 5 minutes for before the... Oh, just I see. Okay. 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 So this Venn diagram is very helpful, I think, for me at least, for thinking about this problem. I start with special relativity holding for just the regular particles. So I'm not changing that. I'm not trying to tamper with that. I'm just saying that the kinds of experiments which are done which lead to those laws is just with the light-like and slower-than-light particles. But And they're verified to be true for all those particles, for all we know. All the experiments done are verify those particles. Now, if there were faster-than-light particles, that's this realm here in the Venn diagram, okay? Well, we want to consider either both as many things as possible, Lorentz symmetry and causality. Or we don't want to, yeah, okay, so... So if we had all three, we're in this little triangle here, then I could use a tachyon to send a message to a relay back in time. Okay? And at that relay, by Lorentz symmetry, I can produce other tachyons which go back further in time, back to the original location. And so I can send a message to myself backward in time, which violates a common, every common sense notion we have about causality. Now, I don't want that. I want to exclude that little middle there. That makes a little very okay. It's an egregious. I would call it an egregious violation of causality. Now, most people who have considered tachyons in the past, it seems like they want to hold on to Lorentz symmetry as much as possible. So they're kind of in this region here. But you see, that's as best as you can do. You have to violate causality there. And it led to all kinds of problems looking at the literature. It kind of lasted until about the mid-70s, and then people kind of got tired of it. But it seemed that the problem was usually involved problems with causality. I found that other people were doing this, but you could break Lorentz symmetry, and that's what I've decided to do in the previous slide. So I attempt to preserve causality as much as possible, which means I can send particles back in time to a space-like location, like to Alpha Centauri, but I can send them, that's 4 light years away, I guess. So I can send them at most 4 light years back to the past, but no more. And any particles that are sent back to me would have to come, you know, into the future of when I sent the particle in the first place. So in that way, I avoid these egregious violations of causality in this theory. It's through Lorentz symmetry breaking. Okay, I also avoid lack of stability. I mean, I avoid instabilities such as decaying vacuums and stuff like that. So it's possible to have, in the quantum field theory, exponentially growing and decaying modes, and I exclude those from the model for physical reasons, because you would have exponentially growing energy momentum tensor in that case. Okay, so that's kind of what I'm saying here. So that's some of the theoretical considerations. So here's a picture of the energy momentum spectrum of a single particle or antiparticle. In the preferred frame, all the energies are positive, and when I boost to another frame, I get negative energies in certain directions, but on the other side, in the other opposite directions, I have a lower bound for my energies. So that enables causality to be preserved. 1 minute, okay. There's also another nice thing, okay, and that's for normalization is also the possibility for normalization when you include the quantum field theory with other free theories. You can you need that renormalization to go through, and this the positivity of the spectrum there on the light as you approach the light cone for infinite energies is crucial for that. Okay, and the last important thing is for a spin 1/2 quantum field theory, we'll get parity breaking automatically for the free theory for tachyonic models. So what am I saying there? Okay, so for an electron, for a massive particle, if I have a right-handed particle, that means the direction of motion and the spin, which is represented by this, are aligned. So the spin is given by an arrow going in the same direction by the right-handed rule. Now, if I have a right-handed particle moving in this direction, it's slower than the speed of light. So I can always boost, as an observer, to a frame moving faster than that particle. Oops. And get a change in the direction of the particle's motion. But the spin direction does not change. So I've changed this from a right-handed to a left-handed particle. And I can do the same going with the left-handed particle, change it to a right-handed one. The argument fails if the particle itself is traveling at the speed of light. So in that case, we're allowed to have only one-handedness. And that's for a reason why for a long time people thought the neutrino was massless, or it was always traveling at the speed of light. If it's faster than light, the argument also fails. In that case, it seems like it's required to have only one-handedness. It's required to have parity breaking. And okay, there is an equation where you stick a gamma 5. These are matrices. This is a gamma 5 matrix. So I can't explain it all, but if you stick that into the equation, then this turns out to be a tachyonic equation where you get a, you know, negative mass squared instead of a positive mass squared. I guess I'm over time. May I still go on for maybe another 1 minute or so?
You have 1 minute for questions or...
Okay. Okay, so anyway, I was going to mention the Mainz, the anomalies of negative mass squared. There was also negative mass squared anomalies seen in pion decay over the years, which were significant until... a mass for the pion was changed or corrected. Also, Mont Blanc had a signal that came 4.7 hours before the Kamiokande, and I calculated based on possibly that might be a muon signal, a tachyonic muon signal, that the mass of the muon neutrino would be about 700 electron volts. And I checked last night some old calculation I did to corroborate that with the dispersion of those Mont Blanc neutrinos. Now, it's not very significant, but when you just plug it into a linear regression here, I showed the result. you get a positive. So if neutrons were tachyonic, then the smaller energies would arrive first, and the energies would sort of grow as they arrived. So the signals are, it's not that clear, but it does give a positive estimate for the, you can see here, positive energy slope versus, you know, energy versus time of arrival is positive. But the significance is very low because the standard error is about twice that much. Okay. My apologetics are, the way I connect this with apologetics is that apology means give a defense. And we're asked all to be prepared to give a defense for our faith in Jesus Christ, according to 1 Peter 3, it should be 1 Peter 3:15, sorry about that. And I'll just leave you with some of these verses. But in your hearts, revere Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. But do this with gentleness and respect. That's analogous to, deciding that I would... There was a time when I was in a church, and somebody, I was considering whether working on this problem, whether I should work on this problem or not, and somebody gave me they didn't know me. I don't know if they knew any physics or anything, but they prayed in German over me. I knew Eines Neues Mass or something. And I understood that kind of, I didn't know what the word Mass meant in German, so I thought, well, God, are you saying something to me about my research? I shouldn't just slam the door on this project. And so I felt he wanted me to, you know, he asked me, Mark, aren't you a scientist? Don't you want to discover something new? So it was kind of like a gentle rebuke, because I was kind of a bit afraid of it, but... So I decided to try not to slam the door on the project and try to keep an open mind. And then a verse came to me around that time, Mark 9:23, all things are possible to the one who believes. So, you know, it's as Christians, we're asked to believe some things which are sometimes embarrassing to talk about. For example, that Jesus is actually God come in the flesh. I mean, who are we to claim that, you know, our religion is so far superior to others? Well, Jesus claim to be God in the flesh, and also that he died and rose again. There's a big miracle there. Nevertheless, I was thinking about this yesterday, that the verse about faith that might have been mentioned. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. And I thought, our faith is like evidence, maybe not for ourselves, but for others as well. If we believe, that might be evidence for somebody else to also believe. And there's a song which goes like that, go in my name, and because you believe, others will know that I live. From the song, it's called Freely, Freely You Have Received, and so on. So I found over the years, trying to think about this topic with an open mind was analogous to Jesus' words that the work of God is this, to believe in the one he sent. Sometimes I found it to be hard work. And another apologetic thing, could the neutrino, a known elementary particle, be the fabled and hypothetical tachyon? This is the same as that. Is Jesus Christ the Messiah? You know, is Jesus the Messiah? Anyway, that's all. And here are references. Thanks.
We don't have time for questions, but would you be willing to answer questions after?
Sure.
Okay, thank you.
Probably pretty good. Oh, thanks. I think this is me here. I should probably wait a little bit, wait a minute and a half. So if somebody wants to ask a question of America right now, would that be fine?
Yeah.
And then just, you know, I'll start in 1 minute.
My question for Merrick is, you didn't even mention the 2011 claim that the neutrinos were moving faster than the speed of light when the Grand Sasso detector claimed that they were seeing neutrinos coming faster than light should have been coming. Then it was later found that perhaps there was a faulty part of their equipment. But I suppose that you got excited about that possibility. Is that true?
Yeah, okay, actually, the context of that happening was I just started my job in Afghanistan, and so it was, and somebody had told me a week before that they were, it was going to be leaked. So it had already been leaked to Kostoletsky, I think. Kostoletsky told me, Alan Kostoletsky. He pretty much said, we need to wait and for confirmation, which is obviously what Eritodato was wanting to do as well. I left a reference there. There's an article called "The Data That Threatened to Break Physics," which is by Ransom Stevens, last name Stevens, first name Ransom, that was put on the internet. I can give the reference for that if you like. It's an interview with Antonio Eritodato saying what he tried to do during that whole time and how actually everybody was excited and that they might have been discovering something new. And when the plug was pulled on it all, that's when he decided to resign because it seemed like it was a big failure. But